The Sputnik was not, however, the beginning of space exploration. This is Dr. Robert Goddard, an American scientist, as you can see, on a very cold day. This was taken about 1926. Dr. Goddard was one of the pioneers of liquid rocket technology. And for centuries before then, the Chinese and other nations had known how to make solid rockets, sky rockets, if you like. But liquid rockets were the way to go into space. You can see at the top there, this is the actual rocket itself. There's the nozzle. There's the fuel tanks up the top there. Tsiolkovsky, the Russian that I mentioned, was doing similar work in Russia at that time. But the real development of rockets as a means of space exploration came during the Second World War. This is a German V2, or as the Germans called it, the A4. You can see the man at the top there as a indication of the scale. It was a liquid fuel rocket. The Germans used them to bombard London, where they had a bomb in the warhead up the pole up the top here, just an ordinary chemical bomb, and they rained a terrible desolation on London. The Russians, as I said, were the first into space. This is a Soyuz rocket taking off from Kazakhstan Baikonur in Kazakhstan, in what's the very southern part of what used to be the Soviet Union. I mentioned the 20 nozzles on the Sputnik rocket. They used the same system here. A lot of engines in there, but it works now very reliably. This is actually a manned launch from Baikonur. And up the top there is the escape tower. The cosmonauts are up the top there in that capsule, and that's the escape rocket. If anything goes wrong, which it has, the last 25 years the Russians have had two failures, and this system has worked very well. It's pulled the cosmonauts off. One of them was on the launch pad, the other one was about 20 kilometres down the range, and they were successfully recovered and they survived. This is the first American satellite launched about 3 months after Sputnik, called Explorer. And the Russians, of course, beat the Americans into orbit, and there was a great race then to try to get the first American satellite into orbit. And the satellites at the very top there, satellites usually are at the top, right at the top there, this whole system here, this whole second and third and fourth stages of the rocket all spun around to stabilise it. And this rocket here is the same one that launched Australia's satellite RESAT in November 1967 from Woomera. You can see the scale down the bottom of the people down there. This is liquid oxygen being vented out of the rocket. That rocket ran on alcohol, somewhat purer than mums and dads here drink, alcohol and liquid oxygen. And that satellite was successfully put into orbit on the 31st of January 1958. Shortly after the first American satellites went up, the Americans began a program of trying to reach the moon. And this is an unmanned moon satellite, which actually it's an Echo 2 satellite, but it's the same system. This is on top of the launch pad, this is the nose shroud here, which goes around the satellite to protect it from the atmosphere when it's going up into space. One interesting, this is about 1960, 61 this photograph was taken. This is supposed to be a sterile environment, a clean room where the satellites can be properly finally put onto the rocket, and there's not supposed to be any contamination or dust or anything. There's a guy down here having a can. See him down there? I'm not sure if it's lemonade or something more potent, but they weren't too worried in those days about keeping things nice and clean. I hope when he pulled the cap off, it didn't spray all over the satellite. This is by the mid-1960s, this was the Americans' armada of rockets. This is now on display at Cape Canaveral. Those of you who are lucky to get over to Florida, take the kids to Disney World and take a day off to go down to Cape Canaveral. It's only about an hour away from Orlando. that's where the real interest is at the Cape. This is an Atlas Mercury. This capsule on the top here carried John Glenn and subsequently three other astronauts into orbit around the Earth in the early 60s. This is the Redstone rocket, the same one we saw before that launched the American Explorer satellite and launched our satellite RESAT from Woomera. Again, with the Mercury capsule on the top, the two American astronauts went into suborbital flight about 115 miles down into the Atlantic from Cape Canaveral in the early 1961. And that the red thing at the top is similar to the Russian thing. It's the escape tower. If anything goes wrong, those rockets can fire or do fire and pull the black capsule off the top of the rocket. These other four here are rockets that launch unmanned satellites. And some of the aerials and things that they used in the 60s, some of the antennas that they used to track satellites. And they're all on display out in the open at Cape Canaveral. And they're all live. They're spare rockets. They're not models. By the early 1960s, the Americans were getting into the manned space race in a big way. And here's a production line at the McDonnell Douglas plant in America of Mercury capsules. And each of these carries one man. There were no women in those days. Well, there were women in those days, but there weren't any women astronauts in those days. You had to be a test pilot. You had to be a certain height. You couldn't be too tall because the capsules were very small, about as big as sitting inside a telephone booth, pretty uncomfortable. And one of these was up for 24 hours. It was a long, sweaty flight. But there were no women astronauts until the shuttle went up in the 1980s. So for 20 years, the Americans never flew a woman astronaut. The Russians did. They flew in 1962. They flew a lady called Valentina Tereshkova, who later actually married a cosmonaut herself. And they've flown since then three or four women, the Russians. So that's simply, it became a production line. And you see them there working on the Mercury capsules. By 1961, the Americans had the Russians and the Americans had put men into orbit. The Americans were still very concerned about being behind. They didn't know what the Russians were going to do. They assumed they were going to land on the moon. President Kennedy saw that the only real chance of the Americans to catch up, which was in those days terribly important to them, because the Cold War was still very much on, and the space race was a technological aspect of the Cold War. President Kennedy announced in May 1961, shortly after Alan Shepard's first suborbital flight from Cape Canaveral, that the Americans were going to try to go to the moon. And this is a speech he made in 1962, which amongst space enthusiasts is very famous. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. And he saw that this was a real challenge for America. He saw it was vitally important that it was a challenge, as he says, because that challenge is one that we are unwilling to postpone and one which we intend to win. And of course, as history has shown us, when it they did. And this is the actual launch of the Saturn V rocket, carrying Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins to the moon in July 1969. That's the liftoff from Cape Canaveral. You can see that the local wildlife, while being somewhat concerned, weren't terribly impressed with the first moon launch, and they just fluttered away. Cape Canaveral is actually a wildlife sanctuary, and if you go there, you can see manatee sea cows. They're a bit like walruses without the tusks, and alligators swimming in the waterways around the Cape, and the birds nest in the trees there. They had a problem with one of the space shuttles a couple of years ago. A pair of woodpeckers decided that it was that the insulation on the external fuel tank on the shuttle was would make wonderful nesting material, and they pecked away at this while it was on the launch pad, unbeknownst to NASA, and they pecked so much away that it posed a danger to the shuttle. They had to pull the shuttle back to the vertical assembly building while they put it together and fix up the insulation before they took it back to the pad and launched it. Goodness knows what additional cost. The woodpeckers are still being looked for. They haven't been found yet. and 7 short years later we were there. This is, so it's one of the Apollos, I think it's about 14 or 15. By that stage they'd got the moon buggy onto the moon, this wonderful little thing, like a glorified ride-on lawnmower or golf buggy, worked by batteries, had 2 seats. There's, you see the edge of one of the seats there with a webbing on it. The aerial antenna to send signals back to Earth. There's the spacecraft they landed in, the lunar module. The top part from there up, just from here, there's the ladder they go down. You can see the handles on the porch, they call it there. This top part blasts off to take the spacecraft back into orbit, where the third astronaut is waiting in the command ship to go back to Earth. And of course, these slides are from the National Space Society in the States, and to the Americans, I suppose to all of us, if we'd have managed to land a man on the moon, we'd be flying our flag as well. Another photo of the moon buggy. They were flown on the last 3 or 4 Apollo flights. Again, you can see the seats there much more clearly. Very simple seats. They had a lot of fun with this. They used to, because the moon's gravity is so much less than the Earth's, they hit a rock and the thing had bounced about 10 feet in the air. It was great fun. They really enjoyed themselves. And you see, it's even got mud guards, or in this case, dust guards. Of course, there's no water on the moon, so there was no mud. But the dust is a very, there's a very thick layer of, not thick, but it's a layer of fine dust particles on the moon's surface, and so they needed the mud guards to cover that. And you see the footprints of the astronauts was there been walking around there. And one of the more spectacular pictures, I think, of the space age, Earthrise from the Moon. That was actually taken from orbit from one of the command modules, and that's the Earth, that's the view from Earth. It's the opposite view that we have. We see the moon rise, and on the moon you see the Earth rise. And it really is a blue planet, blue and white, from a lot of cloud on that one. And the continents are basically brown, and because the oceans are blue. Now, after the Apollo program was finished, both the Americans and the Russians got into space stations, and the Russians launched a number of space stations called Salyut. They launched, I think, 7 altogether, and they were crewed by cosmonauts both from Russia and from the Soviet Union and from the Eastern European states, Hungary and Bulgaria, even over to Cuba and Mongolia. They had guest cosmonauts on board. However, this is the American Skylab spacecraft. Skylab was basically the last stage of a Saturn V rocket, which they converted into a laboratory. And this guy, who I think is Tom Stafford, is not having a filling. He's actually having an oral examination by this astronaut, who's a doctor. And I hope he's strapped in, because, of course, in space you float around, and rather than having to sit in a chair and tilt the chair back so you can get a good look at his mouth, you simply get him to put himself in the right position and strap himself in there, because upside down is the same as right side up in space. There's no upside down, there's no right side up. It's all the same. Skylab is perhaps most famous for when it re-entered the atmosphere in the late 1970s. It dropped large chunks of itself over quite a lot of inland Western Australia, and much to the delight of some of the local farmers who sold some of the bits that they recovered to souvenir hunters for quite a price. Tim, I think we've got some bits of Skylab upstairs, haven't we? Yes, up in the on the next level up, you'll see there's a display case there with some pieces of Skylab recovered from Western Australia. And the National Space Society says quite rightly, unfortunately, we abandoned the new world of the moon, and we didn't give up entirely on space, but instead of colonising the moon, we built the space shuttle. The first shuttle was launched in April 1981, exactly 20 years to the day after Yuri Gagarin, the first man into space, was put into orbit by the Russians for one orbit. And this is a space shuttle launched from Cape Canaveral. you're familiar with what it looks like. This is the external tank that carries the liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen to power the shuttle's engines. It's up here somewhere that the woodpeckers were pecking that took the insulation off the outside of the tank. The two white things on the side are the solid rocket boosters, which, as their name indicates, solid fuel rockets. It was one of those that failed in January 1986 and caused the shuttle Challenger disaster. The only engines on the shuttle, apart from the engines on the solid rocket boosters, are in the shuttle itself, and the fuel, all of that fuel in that brown middle tank is used to fuel the three engines on the shuttle. And because the shuttle comes back to Earth, it brings the engines back with it, and these external tanks here, when they've finished, they float back into the Atlantic on the Atlantic Ocean on parachutes, and ships go out from Cape Canaveral, from Port Canaveral, it's on the ocean there, and they recover them and bring them back, and they're cleaned out and they're used again. So, to that extent, all of the shuttle is reusable apart from this external tank, which is lost when it goes into orbit. The Russian shuttle system was somewhat different. They had the engines in the actual rocket itself, not on their shuttle. But that system's been abandoned. They're not. They've built two shuttles, but they're not going ahead with the program. This is the shuttle tiles actually being replaced on the shuttle orbiter. Every time the shuttle flies, these white ones are the tiles, and the brown and red bits are the parts that are being replaced. Every time it flies, some of the tiles come off. It's a bit like the tiles in your kitchen or bathroom lifting off after a lot of use. You've got to put them back on again. This lady has got a special epoxy. It's a sort of a super glue, and she's replacing some of the tiles. But I've actually seen this being done at Cape Canaveral. It's a very, very labour-intensive business. It can be done extremely accurately, and the tiles have all got to fit perfectly. And every time the shuttle comes back, it takes about 2 or 3 weeks just to refurbish some of the tiles that have come off or been damaged. Now, not everything went right in the American or indeed in the Russian space program. The Russians lost one cosmonaut testing their Soyuz spacecraft, which is the one that they're presently still using to go up to the Mir space station. They then lost three cosmonauts when the capsule depressurized coming down from orbit back to Earth. The air all escaped from the capsule and they basically suffocated. In January 1967, there were three American astronauts, Virgil Grissom, Roger Chaffee and Ed White, inside this capsule on top of a Saturn rocket at Cape Canaveral doing a test. The launch was the first Apollo satellite was to go into orbit around the Earth to test the moon landing system. Was due to take place about 2 weeks after this happened, and there was a fire inside the spacecraft, and the Americans were using a pure oxygen. It wasn't air like we breathe, which is part oxygen, part nitrogen, other gases. This was pure oxygen under pressure, and there was a short circuit inside the wiring. A fire broke out, and before they could get the astronauts out, the whole spacecraft was enveloped in flames, and they were all killed. It was a tragic accident, and one that shocked America to the core. It probably put the Apollo program back by about a year and a half, and the fact that they still managed to get to the moon before the end of the decade, as President Kennedy had promised, albeit by only five months, it was still a remarkable achievement. And the shuttle itself wasn't immune from tragedy and disaster. This is a view of the launch pad the night before the shuttle was launched in January. Challenger was launched in January 1986. It shows icicles on the launch pad in Florida. Now, you think Florida has got a similar climate to Cairns, but it has in the winter time. This was the middle of winter. It has very, very cold weather as well, and this is the reason that they shouldn't have launched the Challenger. When the inquiry took place to find out what happened with the Challenger accident, it was determined that. Sorry, going backwards rather than forwards. This is the actual photograph of the Challenger explosion. There's one of the solid rocket boosters taking off on its own. The crew and the spacecraft are in here somewhere. It's believed that they survived the flight and they were killed when what remained of the capsule of the front of the shuttle hit the Atlantic Ocean. And this was America's second and hopefully last space disaster. What was determined was that this solid rocket booster was made up of segments or pieces, and there are rings called O-rings. They're basically rubber rings which separate the various segments and are designed to keep a tight seal between the parts of the rocket when it's burning. One of them failed because it got basically very cold. It shrank and it became brittle, and you can see from the last slide why it got very cold, because of the icicles and the weather was so cold that morning. A jet of flame escaped from about here on the other one. It wasn't this one, it was the other one that failed. It bored a hole into the side of the big liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen fuel tank, and once that flame hit the liquid hydrogen, there was this enormous explosion, and the shuttle and the crew were lost. So both the Russians and the Americans had their fair share of space failures. This is a artist's conception of the International Space Station. It's a larger version of the Mir, the Russian Mir space station, which is now in orbit, been up there for over 10 years now. You can see the space shuttle here attached to the dock with the space station. These are various modules that the astronauts live and work in. The solar cells to produce the electricity to make the whole thing run. The first launch to start to build the space station will take place in the middle of next year, and by 2002 or 2003 the whole station will be completed and there will be a permanent crew of at least three on the space station. There have been a lot of stories around recently about the Mir space station, about its failing and it's broken down, it's no good anymore. Mir's had more publicity in the last 6 or 8 months than it's had in its whole 10-year lifetime. The problem started off when a ferry craft called Progress collided with the Mir while they were doing some tests with it and damaged. This is the International Space Station. The design is basically similar. Damaged one of the solar panels on the Mir and allowed air to escape from one of the pressurised modules. And a lot of the work that they've been doing on Mir in the last several months has been to try and fix the thing so that it can all be operated again. The Americans had a shuttle Atlantis docked with Mir for the last week or so. That undocked last night our time, and it took up a replacement crew. They've changed over some of the crew. The American astronaut Michael Foy was taken off, and David Wolf was put on. And the American astronauts are staying up there for about 4 months at a time now. This is a very good, Mir is a very good training base for the International Space Station. But as the Space Society says, the shuttle, which is a partially reusable multi-stage vehicle, was supposed to provide routine access to space, but it's been a technical success, but an economic failure. It takes far too long to recycle the shuttle for a launch. It takes at least a month. It was supposed to take a week when it was first designed. And they go on to say, if we're ever going to lower the cost of getting into space enough so that everyone can go, and that means everyone, all of us, not just the astronauts, we're going to need a fully reusable launch vehicle. And the first step in that direction was taken with the DCX. And this is an experimental unmanned rocket which was been tested over the last couple of years at White Sands in New Mexico in the United States. This shows it's either going up or going down, I'm not sure which. It takes off vertically and lands vertically, and the rocket engines are throttleable, the same as you can make your car go faster or slower by pushing the accelerator or taking your foot off the accelerator. So the DCX had throttleable engines, as indeed does the space shuttle. But this was a test rocket to see whether you can get into orbit with a smaller, a cheaper and more simple rocket. Now, if the price of getting into space can be brought down low enough, then producing solar energy in the cloudless skies of space and beaming it down to Earth could become a practical way of meeting some of our energy needs. So this is simply a huge solar collector to collect heat from the sun and convert it into electricity and beam it down to Earth by microwaves. And ultimately, although the technology isn't here yet to do it commercially and economically, ultimately it may be possible to get rid of virtually all the coal-powered fire stations which are causing so much of the greenhouse effect, get rid of burning fossil fuels like coal and wood and oil, and replace them with renewable energy the sun. The sun, of course, is the ultimate renewable energy. We've got lots of sun. The sun's going to be there for as long as the Earth's going to be here. And they say it's time to return to the moon, this time to stay. This is a concept of a moon base. And you can see the Earth rising on the horizon, maybe the blue Earth coming up over the horizon. And these are laboratories. This is looks like a solar panel system to pick up electricity. This is a mobile laboratory with wheels on it there, and there'd be scientific and technical work going on inside that. The moon also possesses helium-3. There's no helium-3 on Earth. Helium-3 would be an ideal fuel to use in non-polluting fusion reactors. So it'd be possible to mine the helium-3 on the moon, take it back to Earth, and use it in nuclear reactors that don't produce any pollution. And beyond the moon, of course, is Mars, a vast new world rich in resources, with a surface area equal to all of Earth's continents combined. Mars is much smaller than Earth, but because it has no oceans, what they're saying there is that if you joined all of Earth's continents together, all of Earth's landmass together, you'd have the same landmass as Mars. Mars has been in the news very much recently. A meteorite which is known to have come from Mars was found last year to possibly contain the fossils from a living organism, something like a bacteria. In July this year, an American spacecraft Pathfinder, which David will be talking to you about immediately after my talk and showing you some video of, Pathfinder landed on the moon, and its little rover Sojourner is still working on the moon 3 months later. And another American spacecraft, Surveyor, reached the moon a couple of weeks ago, and it's in orbit around the moon, making a detailed, we will be making for the next 2.5 years, a detailed map of the of Mars's surface. Mars possesses water, nitrogen, carbon and oxygen and all the other resources to support not only life but a new branch of human civilization. At a Mars base, we'll learn how to grow crops, to make glasses, plastics, ceramics, metals, wires, tubes and habitats. In short, we'll develop the know-how needed to make Mars a future home for waves of immigrants. And here's an actual model of what a Mars colony could look like. Greenhouses here growing plants. The crews living in these habitation modules and the fuel and the fuel tanks and other necessities outside to keep the whole thing going. And a little Mars rover here running around doing exploration. But we haven't got to wait, they say here, for the future to see the benefits from space exploration. I don't think you can talk about space without talking about the side benefits. And the kids here who've been unfortunate enough to have orthodontic treatment will be familiar with this. My glasses don't yet do that, but hopefully they will in the future. Medical research, there's been a huge number of side benefits which have come out of the technology which has had to be created to go to the moon and to build spacecraft. And this is not a rude picture, and this is the last one. This is a plaque which was attached to the Voyager spacecraft, which was launched in the 1970s, and which visited two of the planets in the solar system. This plaque was put on the side of the spacecraft to show anybody who's out there that it came from Earth. Now, Voyager went from Earth here. That's Mars. That's Jupiter. It went around Jupiter, and it went out into the outer reaches of the solar system. It's simply it's still going. It's out. It's left our solar system. It's no longer it can no longer be pulled back by the sun. It had enough speed when it was launched, and when it whizzed by Jupiter, which gave it an extra kick, Jupiter's gravity, to get it out further. This spacecraft will go on forever, forever and ever and ever, until it's either hit by a meteorite, or it collides with a planet, or somebody finds it. And it's the possibility of somebody finding it for that reason that this plaque was put on the side. There's the spacecraft. And obviously a man and a woman, and the universal, well, from our point of view, the universal signal of greeting, the upraised open hand. This is a concept which has now caught on, and the Pathfinder spacecraft, which reached Mars 3 months ago, contains the names of 100,000 members of the Planetary Society, which is an American organisation for people interested in planetary exploration. Next week, an American spacecraft called Cassini is going to be launched from Cape Canaveral in Florida to go into orbit around Saturn in 7 years' time. It'll take us 7 years to get there. And that contains a microchip, a CD-ROM, which has the names of over 600,000 people on it who signed their names and sent them off to NASA in the last couple of years. Okay, now let me just finish up with a couple of additional remarks. The recent discovery of possible fossil remains in a meteorite from Mars, the huge success of the Pathfinder, Sojourner and now Mars Global Surveyor spacecraft in the last few months, and the armada of other spacecraft which are heading towards the other planets in the next 5 years, which have been or will be launched by the United States, Russia, Europe, and Japan, as well as the Galileo spacecraft's exciting discoveries of Jupiter's moon Europa, where there's believed to be a sea below or beneath. A layer of ice which may possibly contain some form of life, and the launching of the Cassini spacecraft that I mentioned in a week or so's time to Saturn. These events may produce the same catalyst for humans to return to the moon and to go to Mars as the Cold War rivalries did for the early space exploration of the 1960s. I believe that nothing would spur on a human mission to Mars as much as positive proof that life has, or better still, does exist on that planet, or that there is life in the oceans under Europa's ice cap or on Saturn's moon Titan. For we humans wish and hope that we are not alone, that life on this third rock from a minor star in a distant part of an obscure galaxy is not just a freakish accident, but that the universe is teeming with life. Fox Mulder in the X-Files TV show has a poster on his wall that says, "I want to believe," and I think all of us do want to believe that there is in fact life out there. And of course today as I speak there is life on Mars. The Sojourner rover is alive and well and crawling over the surface. Let me just finish with a quote from the Russian space visionary Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, who, writing earlier this century, said, when spaceflight was only a dream, "The Earth is the cradle of mankind, but we cannot remain in the cradle forever. In pursuit of light and space, he will timidly at first probe the limits of the atmosphere and later extend his control throughout the solar system. The impossible of today will become the possible of tomorrow." Thank you.